Imagine, if you will, a stagecoach driving over dusty ground. Suddenly, as if from nowhere, it is attacked by a horde of fearsome Indians who circle the wagon, firing arrows at it, and try to board it. And then, alerted by the pioneer's screams, a posse of cowboys arrives, riding their horses to the rescue, firing upon the Indians and driving them back away from the coach. And then, imagine the clouds of dust and gunpowder clearing, and through it all, imagine that you catch sight of Queen Victoria and her attendants, and row upon row of aristocrats, middle-class merchants, and, in the cheap seats, workers and their families, all of them watching and cheering. And imagine all this in London, taking place in a world created by Louis le Prince's brother-in-law. The Shadow Traps, Episode 35. Cowboys and Yorkshiremen. We've seen Le Prince's patent diminished, splintered, and tightened. It came to represent a multi-lens camera and, despite objections, a multi-lens projector as well. But step back a bit to April 1887, and Le Prince's final days in New York, and we find him still pleading with the patent office, growing suspicious of the possibility of corruption there, and deciding that he would be better off continuing his practical experiments in Europe. What did he leave when he sailed to Liverpool in April 1887? He left his family, working and studying, and no doubt looking forward to his return. He left gainful employment on the panoramas. He left informal offers of investment in his machines from his friend and colleague Henry Wolfe. Le Prince, the perfectionist, wasn't ready to show his finished work to the world yet. He may have been victim to the scale of his ambition. He may have considered the idea of a few black and white sequences without sound and with flicker tortuous to watch, in comparison with what he had planned for his machines. Lizzie described the corpse-like whiteness of the projected images, and we might assume from that were that referring to his New York years, then his New York years had achieved so much, yet not enough. And why did he leave at this point? Lizzie tells us that he was nervous about the possibility of rival inventors interfering in his work if he stayed in New York, and that he wanted to continue his work in Europe, where the resources and the expertise were better suited to his work. And also, he may have heard that his mother in Paris was ill and decided to spend time with her. And also, he could start to patent his machines in other countries across Europe. Lizzie would write, "One day, when I was very heartsick and depressed about his going away, he said very quietly and gravely that he had heard of queer things and that he might be safer away. The day my husband sailed, he told me, should anything unforeseen occur, to apply to Mr. Seward at once." This is Clarence A. Seward, the lawyer who you might remember had been involved with Whitley and Le Prince's Lincrusta Walton business. And with that, Le Prince sailed back across the Atlantic to continue his work in Leeds and Paris. And so he went, leaving his wife heartsick, leaving a family that loved him, leaving offers of investment and existing employment, leaving a patent not yet accepted at this point. Le Prince travelled back to Leeds to continue his experiments in earnest. He arrived in England on the 5th of May, 1887. The very next day, he wrote to Lizzie, "Ma bien chérie, I arrived at Liverpool at 2 p.m. yesterday after a delay in the St. George's Channel on account of fog, and had just time to catch the 3 p.m. train, dinnerless and without a minute even to wire. So I took Grandpa and Grandma by surprise at 6 p.m. last night, and we had a jolly good talk about you all. I have been running over the foundry with Grandpa, and I'm going to call at Brown's Bank to see Wilson, Harvey Reynolds, re-photo apparatus, etc., and some little shopping." In Leeds, Le Prince contacted the firm of local woodworkers, William Mason and Son on Woodhouse Lane, and arranged for a young joiner, Frederick Mason, a young Quaker in his 20s and just finishing his apprenticeship, to assist Le Prince in building parts of a camera. For the next 2 or 3 years, Mason would spend most of his working life assisting Le Prince. Le Prince could also count on the support promised him by Joseph Whitley. The intense and somewhat speculative endeavours upon which Le Prince was about to embark in Leeds would only highlight how much he and his father-in-law were kindred spirits. Here's an observation by Whitley's in-law, Arthur Oates, about Joseph. "His invention of spinning brass shells is not a great commercial success, but this result was only obtained after many trying failures which would have broken a weaker spirit." And this, perhaps, could just have easily applied to Le Prince later regarding his own work on motion pictures. And so Le Prince had help from his father-in-law, Joseph Whitley, who was excited by Le Prince's work and had put Whitley Partners at the inventor's disposal. Some of the metalwork was done at the foundry on Hunslet Road, and some mechanical work done at the Croydon Works in Holbeck. One of Le Prince's early machines was a development of the Ferris wheel deliverer stroke viewer that he had first made out of cardboard and wood in America. In Leeds, it had been made by Rhodes Brothers on Hanover Lane, and according to Adolf, it consisted of a double steel wheel with bars across, with square points on which the photos were placed, and a brake and crank mechanism together with lenses and an eyepiece allowed us, on rotating rapidly, to see a man throwing himself about. Certainly, with its use of metal, it was a more sophisticated version of a peephole device, and it is likely that this machine was made around now and in Leeds because Adolf would comment that it had been constructed before he made his French camera. It is not clear where the sequence of the man throwing himself about came from, whether it had been taken on a Le Prince receiver, or a sequence painstakingly made up of posed images from a still camera, or painted or drawn. However, the absence of any further reference to this by Adolf, who had presumably seen it, suggests that it was not considered a truly successful film of continuous motion captured from real life. It would later be mentioned that Le Prince had been using around 100 small mirrors about the size of a safety razor blade in these experiments. Apparently, he was experimenting on the lines of a revolving wheel round which the mirrors were fixed, said the wife of Le Prince's close friend Richard Wilson. This description fits in with the idea of a Ferris wheel deliverer, as it incorporates into it ideas already in use in a popular viewing machine called the praxinoscope, developed by French artist and inventor Emile Reynaud, and patented in 1877. Reynaud, a passionate and innovative lanternist, had found that sequences produced by zoetropes and phenakistoscopes, which were both viewed through spinning slots, suffered from a dimming of colour, which was caused by the card between the slots effectively diluting what the viewer saw as it spun by. Reynaud's solution to this was to use prismatic mirrors. He constructed a spinning polygon of outward-facing mirrors which reflected back inward-facing images placed around a spinning outer cylinder. This allowed the viewer to watch the sequence come to life on the mirrored surface rather than through slots with their accompanying interruptions. The praxinoscope was a seminal piece of science amusante, captivating the public with looped animations of jugglers, hoop-jumping dogs, watermills and clowns. Reynaud at first showed no interest in progressing from illustrations to photographic images, delighting instead in his bewitching animations. However, it is his praxinoscope which bears a striking resemblance to Leprince's viewer, one big difference being that while the praxinoscope sat flat, Leprince's stood as a vertical Ferris wheel type structure. So there must have been an intense burst of initial activity in Leeds, in which Leprince had overseen at least the commencement of the work mentioned above, for after just a few days in the town, he left Leeds again, bound for Paris. Before reaching Paris, however, he planned to stop in London to catch up with his brother-in-law, who, after years of misadventure, had finally struck gold with one of his ambitious ideas. In 1887, a huge swathe of wasteland in central London was transformed into the greatest show on earth. The American Exhibition of the Arts, Inventions, Manufactures, Products and Resources of the United States of America had been designed to showcase the very best of the New World. The heart of the exhibition was to be a building of iron and glass with a principal gallery measuring 1,140 feet by 120 feet. Inside this was to be a vast array of products and inventions, from locomotives to ice machines, firearms to baby carriages and cameras to false teeth. Around the buildings would stretch American-style streets and avenues and approximately 3,000 square metres of gardens and a scattering of musical pavilions in which bands had been engaged to play twice daily. Visitors would walk past a huge diorama of New York Harbour designed by Monsieur Bartholdi, the creator of the Statue of Liberty, and in the evenings the grounds were to be lit by 250 electric lights and 9 giant searchlights. Just as eagerly anticipated as any of these exhibits, however, were the entertainments, including and especially Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, with its true illustration of frontier life. The Wild West Show was contained within a triangle of railway cuttings on 6 acres of land, on which was built an amphitheatre that audiences would reach by crossing a series of temporary bridges. Around the arena were to be corrals and stables, teepees and tents. The American Exhibition was originally to be opened on the 1st of May 1886, but had been postponed. The reason for this, depending on who you asked or who you believed, was either that Whitley had graciously agreed to move the date of his exhibition so as not to clash with a colonial exhibition already due to be held in 1886, or because of some controversy around Whitley's misrepresentative claim of royal patronage. Whatever the reason, the delay seems to have cost him the goodwill of many would-be exhibitors, many of these from the East Coast. Further disaster struck when the President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, withdrew his support and involvement with the exhibition. The East Coast was falling away from him, and it was the East Coast that Whitley wanted. Philadelphia, New York, Boston, the civilized side of America, the recognisably Anglo-Saxon, urban side, the side where the businesses, the invention, the fine arts were. In a last-ditch attempt to save the exhibition, Whitley sailed back to America. As the story goes, he was sat at a hotel window in Washington, waiting for a promised interview with the president, when his attention was caught by a strange procession. It was not a circus, though somewhat like one, perhaps at first sight, but only the Wild West show of a personage popularly known as Buffalo Bill, a show which presented living and moving pictures of a fast vanishing phase of national existence on the ever receding frontier line between the territory of the white man and the happy hunting grounds of the Redskins. While contemplating this curious pageant, a sudden thought struck Mr. Whitley. Why not console ourselves, he asked, for the defection of the eastern states by enlisting on our side those of the west? Is not Buffalo Bill with his cowboys and his Indians every bit as much a genuine product of American soil as Edison's telephones or Pullman's railway cars? The Honourable Colonel William F. Cody, better known to the world as Buffalo Bill, had already lived an action-packed life by the time Whitley spotted him. Born in Iowa in 1846, his parents were abolitionists whose anti-slavery stance frequently put them in danger. As a boy, Cody became a rider for the Pony Express, and as a young adult, an enlisted Union soldier during the Civil War, where he befriended and worked alongside such legendary figures as Kit Carson, Wild Bill Hickok, and General George Armstrong Custer. Like John Whitley, he had many grand plans, several of which overreached themselves. Running a hotel, for example, opening a gold mine, building an entire town called Rome. But it was his work as a buffalo hunter contracted to supply the US Army with food that led to his nickname of Buffalo Bill, and it was his work as an Army scout which set him on his path to immortality. Edward Zane Carroll Judson, better known as Ned Buntline, was a writer of Western dime novels such as The Hero of 100 Fights and The Fiend of Blood, and was America's highest paid writer, earning more than Mark Twain and Walt Whitman. In 1869, Buntline travelled out west in search of further material for his books. He had wanted to talk to Major North of the 5th Cavalry. However, North wasn't particularly interested in spending time being interviewed by a dime novelist, and instead pointed Buntline towards the 23-year-old Cody, who happened to be under a wagon sleeping off a hangover. Buntline spoke with Cody instead, and as a result of the encounter, an embellished version of Cody's tales of life as a frontiersman became the first installment of the serial Buffalo Bill, the King of the Bordermen, in the 20th of December 1869 issue of the New York Weekly. Cody stroke Buffalo Bill continued work as a scout whilst simultaneously being a celebrity. Ned Buntline, however, was keen to capitalise on his new creation and persuaded Cody to go east and try out a career in show business. Buntline had hastily concocted a terrible western potboiler for the stage called The Scouts of the Prairie. It almost didn't matter how bad it was. The audiences would not be coming for the language, but to see real, authentic characters from the Wild West. The play opened on 18th of December 1872, with Bill playing himself and Texas Jack Omohundro playing Texas Jack Omohundro, and it began a run which generated terrible reviews and packed houses, and in the process effectively invented the Western. Wild Bill Hickok was actually persuaded to act in some of the plays for a while, but he didn't last long as he hated it and had a habit of getting drunk and beating up members of the audience. What's interesting from a 21st century perspective is how easily Buffalo Bill stepped back and forth between these different lives. It isn't often today that anyone who's achieved fame steps or is allowed to step back into the worlds of conflict and deprivation in anything more than a superficial manner. However, Cody resumed his scouting duties for US Army patrols. However, his life in show business wasn't completely discarded, and he started going out on patrol in his stage costumes. For example, a black velvet Mexican vaquero's costume slashed with scarlet and set off by silver buttons and lace trimming, and a plumed sombrero. It was during this time that he killed Yellowhand, the son of a Cheyenne chief, in an engagement genuine and written up in military reports at the time that would nevertheless be dramatized and exaggerated and become a key part of the Wild West show in years to come. In 1882, Cody met a fellow performer and former Army drummer boy named Nate Salisbury. Together, they conceived of a form of show which would bring together elements of the theatre with more sporting pursuits such as horse riding and sharpshooting demonstrations. And so, the idea of the Wild West show was born, and it began as a loose confection of scenes and stunts centred around life on the western frontier. The theme that pulled it all together, at least the theme presented to the audience and the press, was the idea of manifest destiny, the idea that the transformation of the West from wild Indian tribal lands to tamed and anglicised towns and cities was an inevitable aspect of the march of civilization. It celebrated, romanticized, exaggerated, lied and told truths about a way of life that, even in the 1880s, was seen as in its final days. The Wild West Show toured the states, gaining in popularity and scale and commercial success. When Whitley encountered it in 1884, the timing was fortuitous. Salisbury and Cody were looking for new and larger audiences, and Whitley was looking for a way to save his American exhibition. I see similarities between Cody and Whitley. For example, I think they were both indefatigable dreamers who were acutely aware of their own public images and who bent and manipulated the facts of their lives to reinvent themselves. Let's look, for example, at their respective accounts of how the Wild West Show came to be headed to London from the perspectives of Whitley, Cody and Nate Salisbury. Just look at the subtle repositioning of the spotlight as we pass from narrator to narrator. Salisbury. The American exhibition in London was the conception of John Robinson Whitley, a man of most undoubted ability as an organiser and a man of equally unscrupulous ability as a financier. He happened one day to be in Philadelphia when the Wild West was exhibiting there. He wrote me afterwards to know if I would entertain an offer for London. Buffalo Bill. One day an Englishman, whose name I never learnt, came to see me after the show. That is a wonderful performance, he told me. Here in America it meets with great appreciation, but you have no idea what sensation it would be in the old world, where such things are unheard of. Whitley. While contemplating this curious pageant, a sudden thought struck Mr. Whitley. Why not console ourselves, he asked, for the defection of the eastern states, by enlisting on our side those of the West? No sooner thought than done, and the following day Buffalo Bill had agreed to come over to London. Buffalo Bill. That set me to thinking. In a few days, I had made up my mind that Europe should have an opportunity to study America as nearly at first hand as possible through the medium of my entertainment. And these slight but telling inconsistencies continue on and on, three huge egos jostling for prime position. The prospect of Buffalo Bill visiting Britain was met with a huge sense of excitement from all quarters of life. Oscar Wilde, for example, anticipated Buffalo Bill's arrival with excitement. English people are far more interested in America's barbarism than they are in America's civilization, he wrote in The American Invasion. Better the West with its grizzly bears and its untamed cowboys, its free open-air life and its free open-air manners, its boundless prairie and its boundless mendacity. This is what Buffalo Bill is going to bring to London, and we have no doubt that London will fully appreciate his show. And there was another artiste who had fully appreciated his show. Mr. Henry Irving, speaking of the show on his return from America last September, said, "No one can exaggerate the extreme excitement and go of the whole performance, and I venture to predict that when it comes to London, it will take the town by storm." Whitley's great ally in marketing the exhibition, both at home and in the States, was the actor Henry Irving, who was at the time the greatest, certainly the most famous actor in the world. It was his loyal and long-suffering assistant, the writer Bram Stoker, who would in a few years use his aloof, demanding boss as a model for his most famous creation, Count Dracula. Back in the wet spring of 1887, a physical transformation was taking place. At the beginning of the year, the site at Earl's Court in West Brompton was one huge cabbage patch. Whitley employed 2,000 men working in two groups, one for labouring during the day and one for night work, to create, out of nothing, nothing less than a miniature version of America. Whitley would later say, with typical understatement, "No heavier work has ever fallen the lot of soldiers in wartime than that which falls upon two or three of the men who lead in exhibition work." Let's put aside the melodrama for a second. It was a grand scheme. It was breathtaking in its ambition. But could Whitley do it in time? As the opening date of the 9th of May approached, obstacles accrued. In March, heavy snowfall interrupted building work. It soon became clear that parts of the exhibition simply wouldn't be finished in time for the opening. But Whitley still went to it and hired an extra 800 men to push the work along. The press covered it daily, and the public held its breath. By April 1887, it was time for the Wild West show to make its way to London. Cody and Salisbury chartered the steamship, the SS Nebraska. I have put together a short account of the journey to England, just using contemporary quotations. It is, I think, a kaleidoscope of perspectives. "Soon he'll cross the Atlantic in quest of new game, with horses half frantic and riders the same. A novel sensation he'll make in this nation, so cheers half a hundred for Buffalo Bill." Punch. For exhibitions, the entourage included bands of Indians, 110 in number, Sioux, Cheyenne, Ogallalas, Arapahoes, Shoshones and other tribes, with their squaws and children, all under the command of Red Shirt, a magnificent specimen of redskin manhood, cowboys and Mexican prairie riders to the number of about 150, with 170 bronco horses and Indian ponies, comprising some wild and incorrigible buckers, 12 mules, 64 various tents, a dozen emigrant wagons, 9 elk, 2 deer, 8 wild Texas steers, 16 buffaloes, 200 Mexican and cowboy saddles, 100 Indian saddles, with a formidable armory of American and Indian weapons, and last of all, the famous Deadwood stagecoach, in the same condition as when last attacked by Indians and highwaymen. The Era newspaper. Prior to embarkation, the Sioux and Ogallala Indians squatted in circles on the docks and proceeded to invoke the goodwill of the gods before starting on an expedition. Buffalo Bill. It was a strange voyage. The Indians had never been to sea before and had never dreamed that such an expanse of water existed on the planet. Black Elk, one of the performers. "After a while, I could see nothing but water, water, water. We were all in despair now, and many were feeling so sick that they began to sing their death songs. Annie Oakley. En route to London, we encountered terrific storms that smashed our propellers. We drifted helpless in the trough of the sea for 48 hours. For 48 hours, the old grizzled Scotch captain never left the deck. Before I left the bridge, word came up, all ready, and the boat made a dangerous turn and headed towards London. We had drifted 264 miles out of our course. Not a passenger except my husband and myself knew we had been in danger of losing our lives. Black Elk. We did not sleep at all, and in the morning the water looked like mountains. Some of the bison and elk that we had with us for the show died that day, and the Wisichus, the white men, threw them in the water. When I saw the poor bison thrown over, I felt like crying, because I thought there they were throwing part of the power of my people away. Buffalo Bill. The joy that seized them when at last they came in sight of land was something worth looking at. The Era. The anxiety felt respecting the Indians and the animals who had never been to sea before was groundless. With the exception of a horse which was sick at the start, there was no loss, and the Indians really enjoyed the voyage. The Honourable Mr. Cody, Buffalo Bill, came to town on Thursday night, but the company remained on board. The Daily News. The whirr of the steam winch, the shout of the men engaged in landing cargo, and the miscellaneous bustle around were exciting enough. But the noble red men kept firm. Nothing disturbed their placidity now that the voyage was over, any more than on the voyage. Looking upon the chiefs, braves and squaws, one could not help recalling the delightful sensations of youth, the first acquaintance with the last of the Mohicans, the Great Spirit, Firewater. Here were their counterparts, moccasins, feathers, and a fine show of war paint, dignified countenances which retained a stamp of high breeding through ochre and vermilion. Not a glance was wasted upon a stranger. All that came to the Indians was taken for granted. An archbishop in all his finery would have fallen short of their mark. Black Elk. And then they unloaded us, and took us to a place where the show was going to be. The name of this very big town was London. London. While Buffalo Bill slept in the luxurious Hotel Metropole, the rest of the Wild West troop camped out at Earl's Court, under the stars and the eerie lucigen lamps and bonfires that lit the grounds. It was a dreamlike setting, made all the more so by the huge painted canvas panoramas and artificial hills that blocked out the sight of the surrounding London neighbourhoods, save for those chimneys and rooftops that jutted over the tops of it all. If you read through the newspapers of April 1887 to October 1887, you are struck by how Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show became the sensation of that year. The papers followed the performers' every move, from the cowboys scandalising the upper classes by galloping down well-to-do streets on horseback on the Sabbath, or starting saloon bar fights in the Lily Arms pub, or the Native American performers visiting Parliament and discussing policies with William Gladstone. It was a Wild West show that captured the nation's imagination in 1887. The Era. No London reunion will be considered complete without the presence of a stage driver or a cowboy. The creme de la creme will, of course, seize upon Buffalo Bill and Buck Taylor, whose visiting list will soon become inconveniently full. Mrs. Ponsonby de Jones and stars of lesser magnitude will have to content themselves with the rank and file of the show, whilst in genteel Bayswater, even a Mexican will be considered an acquisition. And now, enter Henry Irving again, stage right, accompanied by Bram Stoker, acting manager of the Lyceum Theatre. Irving played host to the performers of the Wild West show, and Irving befriended Cody and introduced him to the gentlemen's clubs of London, where Cody could often be found, lounging on leather armchairs and regaling aristocrats with his tales of the wild frontiers. Bram Stoker, loyal and ever obliging, often tagged along. It's interesting to see how Stoker observed Cody, because he later transformed him into a character in his novel Dracula. Quincy Morris, the brave but ill-fated American plainsman who becomes one of the novel's vampire hunters, is clearly modelled on Buffalo Bill. If America can go on breeding men like that, she will be a power in the world indeed. That quotation from Dracula about Morris is exactly the kind of view the British press held about Cody, and Cody, who saw himself and the Wild West as having an ambassadorial role to play in England, only encouraged this view. On the 19th of April, 1887, a group of Wild West performers, including Chief Redshirt and Buck Taylor, attended a performance of Henry Irving's Faust at the Lyceum. Faust was a theatrical sensation full of dazzling special effects, with Irving playing Mephistopheles, a sinewy, snarling devil. When asked for his impressions of the play, Redshirt described it as like a dream. But now we come to the reason all these characters were assembled together in the first place. The opening day of the American exhibition, May the 9th, 1887. Newspapers reported an estimated attendance of 28,000 people on the first day. 28,000 people who streamed through the gates and wandered through this America in miniature, who walked past the panoramas and the bandstands and the bars selling nogs, slings, cocktails, cobblers, skins, fizzes, sours and ticklers, who explored the principal gallery with rooms still unfinished. Whitley, incidentally, seems to have started, or at least continued, that great British tradition of selling terrible overpriced food at large events, as journalists complained of those purveyors of dyspepsia, the refreshment contractors. The opening ceremony itself was about as lackluster in liveliness as such events invariably are. The crowds were subjected to interminable speeches, culminating in one from Whitley himself, politely described as florid, in which he had just reached the point where he exhorted the audience to join us in the further development of the new world, when the audience took that as their cue, or perhaps an excuse, to rush out through the exits before the speech was even finished and move out towards a Wild West auditorium, while the startled band played Dixie and Whitley and his fellow dignitaries were left standing. Over at the Wild West arena, the stands filled, and Dan Godfrey's cowboy band struck up a tune, and then a lone figure strode out towards the crowds. Not Buffalo Bill, but the orator of the Wild West show, Frank Richmond, who made his way to a raised lectern in full view of the stands, and in a booming voice announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, Buffalo Bill and Nate Salsby proudly present America's national entertainment, the one and only genuine and authentic, unique and original, Wild West." Again, music. And then the audience's first sight of the full mounted company as it raced towards them and around the arena in a whirl of whoops, war cries and dust. Last to enter was the man himself, Buffalo Bill, approaching enigmatically on his mount before saluting the crowd. At last, after months of anticipation, the Wild West was finally here. The first sequence was a horse race between a Native American performer, a cowboy and a Mexican vaquero, unusual in that it wasn't fixed to allow the cowboy to win. Then came the female sharpshooter, the one and only Annie Oakley, 60 years from being immortalised by Irving Berlin, but already a celebrity and an implicit challenge to attitudes towards women in Victorian society. In her act, clay pigeons were hurled, shot and shattered, and the popular mirror shot routine was performed, in which Oakley shot back over her shoulder at a playing card held by her husband, Frank Butler. This was followed by the recreation of a Pony Express ride, complete with Indian pursuit. Then an emigrant wagon train appeared, only to be attacked by a horde of galloping, fearsome Indians in full war paint. Shots were fired, arrows aimed and the wagons circled to defend themselves, and the Indians advanced until, just in the nick of time, a rescue party led by Buffalo Bill arrived on the scene. Having chased off the Indians, Bill's Rough Riders and the emigrants all joined in an elaborate square dance performed on horseback. The show's second female sharpshooter, Lillian Smith, then gave her own demonstration, shooting eggs and glass balls. She was joined by Oakley as they both rode around the arena at high speed, stooping low to grab pistols from the ground before shooting at targets. This was followed by cowboy fun and sequences of death-defying stunts, including riding the bucking broncos. Then, the old Deadwood stagecoach was pulled into the arena. It was, as the orator bellowed to the crowd, a part of American history, having been baptized in fire and blood. The stagecoach was attacked by Indians, who climbed onto the roof and fired in through the windows. Once again, it was Buffalo Bill at the head of a posse of Rough Riders who saved the day, rushing in and fending off the attackers. Then, two set pieces featuring the Native Americans. First, a horse race between the Braves, and then a sequence entitled Life Customs of the Indians, in which the entire company of Native Americans entered the arena on horseback, carrying with them the poles, canvases and skins to set up a prairie camp. In a matter of minutes, the camp was set up by the squaws before the men demonstrated not only a war dance but a scalping too. This part of the show relied less on blood and thunder theatrics and introduced an ethnographic element to the whole. And then our hero, Buffalo Bill, returned for a star turn, riding his favourite mount, Old Charlie, and shooting glass balls with his 44 caliber Winchester rifle. Next, the buffalo were let loose to be herded together by Buffalo Bill and a hunting party of Native Americans, all the while with the orator providing his bellowing commentary. The climactic act of the show was called the attack on a settler's cabin. A small log hut set on wheels was pushed into the centre, and performers playing a settler family began preparing supper when, surprise, surprise, a gang of hostile Indians burst into the arena and attacked the cabin. Once again, having been alerted by the settlers' screams, Buffalo Bill charged onto the scene, leading his cowboys, and a spectacular shootout began, which left several Indians dead, the settlers safe, and Bill triumphant. As the gunpowder cleared, the finale began, in which the entire company paraded by the audience while a cowboy band played the national anthem. 2.5 hours of adrenaline, romanticism, historical revisionism and fun. Afterwards, the spectators could wander through the encampments around the arena. The next day, the newspaper coverage for the exhibition was completely outdone by the news coverage for the Wild West show. It was instantly a critical and a commercial sensation. The show continued playing twice daily for the next 6 months, and the performers continued to be the darlings of the press. And they did all this in this world that had been created by John Robinson Whitley. And by creating this world, Whitley had become an industrial P.T. Barnum. He had become, for a moment, the greatest showman on earth. On the 5th of May 1887, a few days before the official opening of the 9th, John Robinson Whitley had given the Prince of Wales a private showing of his Earl's Court extravaganza, and Buffalo Bill's Rough Riders had thrilled the royal guests. That same day was the day that Louis le Prince had arrived in England from New York. We've seen that he was there for just a few days, preparing intensely for his work on the cameras, before meeting his brother-in-law in London. Le Prince travelled down to London and met up not only with John, but with Joseph and Sarah Whitley too, who had also come down to see the opening of the exhibition. They all partook of a celebratory meal, which was interrupted by a visit from the Queen's messenger informing Whitley, as Director General of the exhibition, that Queen Victoria had requested to attend a performance. Queen Victoria had, 26 years earlier, withdrawn from public life following the death of her beloved husband, Prince Albert. Therefore, Whitley was to host the first official public performance attended by the Queen in over a quarter of a century. At this moment, on the eve of her Jubilee, in fact, Victoria could have chosen from a host of performers, from Henry Irving's legendary staging of Faust at the Lyceum Theatre, to the premiere production of the latest Gilbert and Sullivan production at the Savoy. But it was Cody and the Wild West which had drawn her out after so many years in mourning. In England, the stamp of royal approval stands for much, but the notice was short, and through the night wires hummed and messengers hurried. Exhibition officials and a long list of patrons had to be notified, decorators and florists summoned to hold themselves in readiness to prepare for Her Majesty's formal reception, and in a few small hours a small army was at work. For Whitley and Cody it was to be a grand coup, and for Le Prince another brief excursion along the margins of history. The day's highlight was always going to have been the Wild West performance, reviews of which were already whipping up excitement in the capital and beyond. The Queen, along with the Prince and Princess of Battenberg, their courtiers and assorted members of the nobility, were seated in specially prepared boxes. It had been arranged for the General Director's young daughter, Dorothy, to present the Queen with a bouquet of flowers, and Le Prince was asked to accompany her up. Having been presented with a bouquet, the Queen was heard to remark to her lady-in-waiting, "That is one of the handsomest men and the loveliest child I have seen." Le Prince was originally meant to have had more than just a walk-on part at the American exhibition. John had been keen to display Le Prince's cameras there, and that had indeed been the plan for a while. However, as the exhibition opening approached, Le Prince decided it was too soon and too unsafe to show a machine with which he was not entirely satisfied. Le Prince's perfectionism in the face of the impatience of others is a developing theme of the story, and now, in 1887, his artistic sense made him detect the slightest vibration and abhor the corpse-like whiteness of the moving figures. And that's according to Lizzie in her memoirs. Perhaps Le Prince thought he had time, that there would be further opportunities to work with Whitley down the line. But looking back now, we must shudder to think at what might have been if Le Prince had been ready and had combined with his brother-in-law, who had at this moment got the world's attention. A moving picture camera presented on the biggest stage possible. What a thought. Having met John and Joseph and Sarah, having seen the American exhibition, and having presented the bouquet of flowers to the Queen, Le Prince left London and continued on his way to Paris, making his way inexorably towards the birth of film. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Shadow Traps. If you'd like to learn more about the project or to support it in any way, please visit the Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theshadowtraps. Thank you very much for listening.